Chapter 37. It was late evening, July 27th. They were camped on what the sign, now half demolished by summer storms, proclaimed to be the Kunkel Fairgrounds. Kunkel itself, Kunkel, Ohio, was south of them. There had been some sort of fire there, and most of Kunkel was gone. Stu said it had probably been lightning. Harold had, of course, disputed that. These days, if Stu Redmond said a fire truck was red, Harold Lauder would produce facts and figures proving that most of them these days were green. She sighed and rolled over. Couldn't sleep. She was afraid of the dreams. To her left, the three motorcycles stood in a row, heeled over on their kickstands, moonlight twinkling along their chromed exhaust pipes and fittings. As if a band of Hell's Angels had picked this particular spot to crash for the night. Not that the Angels would ever have ridden such a pussycat bunch of bikes as these Hondas and Yamahas, she supposed. They had driven hogs. Or was that just something she had picked up from the old American International bike epics? The Wild Angels, the Devil's Angels, Hell's Angels on Wheels. The bike pictures had been very big at the drive-ins when she had been in high school. Wells Drive-In, Sanford Drive-In, South Portland Twin. You pays your money and you takes your choice. Now kaput. All the drive-ins were kaput, not to mention the Hell's Angels and good old American International Pictures. Put it in your diary, Franny, she told herself, and rolled over on her other side. Not tonight. Tonight she was going to sleep, dreams or no dreams. 20 paces from where she was lying, she could see the others, zonked out in their sleeping bags. Harold, Stu, Glenn Bateman. Take Somanex tonight and sleep. It wasn't Somanex they were on, but half a grain of Veranol apiece. It had been Stu's idea when the dreams got really bad and they all began to get flaky and hard to live with. He had taken Harold aside before mentioning it to the rest of them, because the way to flatter Harold was to soberly ask his opinion, and also because Harold knew things. It was good that he did, but it was also rather spooky, as if they had a fifth-rate god traveling with them. More or less omniscient, but emotionally unstable and likely to fragment at any time. Harold had picked up a second gun in Albany, and now he wore the two pistols crisscrossed like a latter-day Johnny Ringo. She felt badly for Harold, but Harold had also begun to frighten her. She knew just how Stu would have put it to him, very quietly, almost conspiratorially. Harold, these dreams are a problem. I've got an idea, but I don't know exactly how to carry it out. A mild sedative, but it would have to be just the right dose. Too much and nobody would wake up if there was trouble. What do you suggest? Harold had suggested they try a whole grain of Veranol, available at any drugstore, and if that interrupted the dream cycle, then they cut back to 3/4 of a grain, and if that worked, to 1/2. Stu had gone privately to Glenn, had gotten a concurring opinion, and the experiment had been tried. At 1/4 grain, the dreams had begun to creep back in, so they held the dosage at 1/2. At least for the others. Franny accepted her drug each night, but palmed it. She didn't know if the Veranol would hurt the baby or not, but she was taking no chances. They said that even aspirin could break the chromosome chain. So she suffered the dreams. Suffered, that was the right word. One of them predominated. If the others were different, they would sooner or later blend into this one. She was in her Ogunquit house, and the dark man was chasing her. Up and down shadowy corridors, through her mother's parlor where the clock continued to tick off seasons in a dry age. She could get away from him, she knew, if she didn't have to carry the body. It was her father's body, wrapped in a bedsheet, and if she dropped it, the dark man would do something to it, perform some awful desecration on it. So she ran, knowing that he was getting closer and closer, and at last his hand would fall on her shoulder, his hot and sickening hand. She would go boneless and weak, and her father's shrouded corpse would slither out of her arms. She would turn, ready to say, "Take him, do anything, I don't care, just don't chase me anymore." And there he would be, dressed in some dark stuff like a hooded monk's robe, nothing visible of his features save his huge and happy grin. And in one hand he held the bent and twisted coat hanger. That was when the horror struck her like a padded fist, and she struggled up from sleep, her skin clammy with sweat, her heart thudding, wanting never to sleep again. Because it wasn't the dead body of her father that he wanted, it was the living child in her womb. She rolled over again. If she didn't go to sleep soon, she really would take out her diary and write in it. She had been keeping the journal since July 5th. In a way, she was keeping it for the baby. It was an act of faith, faith that the baby would live. She wanted it to know what it had been like, how the plague had come to a place called Agunquit, how she and Harold had escaped, what became of them. She wanted the child to know how things had been. If she had to exist in a world like this, with a biological clock inside her set to go off in 6 months, she wanted someone like Stu Redmond to be her man. No, not someone like. She wanted him. There it was, stated with complete baldness. With civilization gone, all the chrome and gee-jaws had been stripped from the engine of human society. Glenn Bateman held forth on this theme often, and it always seemed to please Harold inordinately. Women's lib, Franny had decided, was nothing more nor less than an outgrowth of the technological society. Women were at the mercy of their bodies. They were smaller, they tended to be weaker. A man couldn't get with child, but a woman could. Every four-year-old knows it. And a pregnant woman is a vulnerable human being. Civilization had provided an umbrella of sanity that both sexes could stand beneath. And the women's credo, which should have been hung in the offices of Ms. Magazine, preferably in needlepoint, "Thank you, men, for the railroads. Thank you, men, for inventing the automobile and killing the Red Indians who thought it might be nice to hold on to America for a while longer, since they were here first. Thank you, men, for the hospitals, the police, the schools. Now I'd like to vote, please, and the right to set my own course and make my own destiny. Once I was chattel, but now that is obsolete. Thank you, men." And what was there to say? Nothing. The rednecks could grunt about burning bras, the reactionaries could play intellectual little games, but the truth only smiles. Now all that had changed. In a matter of weeks it had changed. How much, only time would tell. But lying here in the night, she knew that she needed a man. Oh, God, she badly needed a man. Now it was all a matter of preserving herself and her baby. Stu attracted her, especially after Jess Ryder. Stu was calm, capable, and most of all, he was not what her father would have called 20 pounds of bullshit in a 10-pound bag. He was attracted to her as well. She knew that perfectly well, had known it since that first lunch together on the 4th of July in that deserted restaurant. For a moment, just one moment, their eyes had met and there had been that instant of heat, like a power surge when all the needles swung over to overload. She guessed Stu knew how things were, too, but he was waiting on her, letting her make her decision in her own time. She had been with Harold first, therefore she was Harold's chattel. A stinking macho idea, but she was afraid this was going to be a stinking macho world again, at least for a while. If only there was someone else, someone for Harold. But there wasn't, and she was afraid she could not wait long. She thought of the day Harold, in his clumsy way, had tried to make love to her. How long ago? 2 weeks? It seemed longer. All the past seemed longer now. It had pulled out like warm Bonomo's Turkish taffy. Between her worry of what to do about Harold and what he might do if she did go to Stuart, and her fear of the dreams, she would never get to sleep. So thinking, she drifted off. From Fran Goldsmith's diary, July 6, 1980. After some persuasion, Mr. Bateman has agreed to come along with us. So tomorrow we're off for Stovington, and I know Stu doesn't like the idea much. He's scared of that place. I like Stu very much, only wish Harold liked him more. Harold is making everything very hard, but I suppose he can't help his nature. G.B. has decided to leave Kojak behind. He is sorry to have to do that, even though Kojak will have no trouble finding forage. Still, there is nothing else for it, unless we could find a motorcycle with a sidecar. And even then, poor Kojak might get scared and jump out, hurt or kill himself. Anyway, tomorrow we'll be going. Things to remember. The California Angels baseball team had a pitcher named Nolan Ryan who pitched all kinds of no-hitters and things with his famous fastball, and a no-hitter is very good. There were TV comedies with laugh tracks, and a laugh track was people on tape laughing at the funny parts, and they were supposed to make you have a better time watching. You used to be able to get frozen cakes and pies at the supermarket and just thaw them out and eat them. Sara Lee strawberry cheesecake was my personal favorite. July 7th, 1980. Can't write long. Cycled all day. My fanny feels like hamburger and my back feels like there's a rock in it. I had that bad dream again last night. Harold has also been dreaming about that ... man ... and it upsets the hell out of him because he can't explain how both of us can be having what is essentially the same dream. Stu says he is still having that dream about Nebraska and the old black woman there. She keeps saying he should come and see her any time. Stu thinks she lives in a town called Holland Home or Hometown or something like that. Says he thinks he could find it. Harold sneered at him and went into a long spiel about how dreams were psycho-Freudian manifestations of things we didn't dare think about when we were awake. Stu was angry, I think, but kept his temper. I'm so afraid that the bad feeling between them may break out into the open. I wish it didn't have to be this way. Anyway, Stu said, "So how come you and Franny are having the same dream?" Harold muttered something about coincidence and just stalked off. Stu told Glenn and I that he would like us to go to Nebraska after Stovington. Glenn shrugged and said, "Why not? We have to go somewhere." Things to remember. There were gasoline shortages because we had used up most of our oil supplies, and the Arabs had us by the short hairs. The Arabs had so much money they literally couldn't spend it. There was a rock and roll group called The Who that sometimes used to finish their live performances by smashing their guitars and amplifiers. This was known as conspicuous consumption. July 8, 1980. Harold finished his sign about an hour ago, with much bad grace, I must say, and put it on the front lawn of the Stovington installation. Stu helped him put it up and held his peace in spite of all Harold's mean little jibes. I had tried to prepare myself for the disappointment. I never believed Stu was lying, and I really don't think Harold believed he was either. So I was sure everyone was dead, but still, it was an upsetting experience, and I cried. I couldn't help myself. After we went in and looked around a little, Stu wouldn't come in. He won't talk about it much, but I'm sure something really bad happened to him in their diary. Stu told us again that he wanted to go to Nebraska. He had a stubborn, sort of embarrassed look on his face, as if he knew he was going to have to take some more patronizing shit from Harold. But Harold was too unnerved from our tour of the Stovington facility to offer much more than token resistance. And even that stopped when Glenn said, in a very reticent way, that he had dreamed of the old woman the night before. Stu and Glenn's dreams of the old woman are very similar. The points of similarity are almost too many to go into, which is my literary way of saying my fingers are going numb. Anyway, they both agree she is in Polk County, Nebraska, although couldn't get together on the actual name of the town. Stu says Hollingford Home, Glenn says Hemingway Home. Close either way. They both seem to feel they could find it. Note well, diary, my guess is Hemingford Home. Glenn said, "This is really remarkable. We all seem to be sharing an authentic psychic experience." Harold poo-pooed, of course, but he looked like he'd been given lots of food for thought. He would only agree to go on the basis of, we have to go somewhere. We leave in the morning. I'm scared, excited, and mostly happy to be leaving Stovington, which is a death place. July 19th, 1980. Oh, Lord, the worst has happened. At least in the books when it happens, it's over. Something at least changes. But in real life, it just seems to go on and on, like a soap opera where nothing ever comes to a head. Maybe I should move to clear things up, take a chance, but I'm so afraid something might happen between them. Let me tell you everything, dear diary, even though it's no great treat to write it down. I even hate to think about it. Glenn and Stu went into town, which happens to be Girard, Ohio, tonight, near dusk, to look for some food, hopefully concentrates and freeze-dried stuff. They're easy to carry, and some of the concentrates are really tasty, but as far as I'm concerned, all the freeze-dried food has the same flavor, namely dried turkey turds. And when have you ever had dried turkey turds to serve as your basis for comparison? Never mind, diary. Some things will never be told. Ha ha. They asked Harold and I if we wanted to come, but I said I'd had enough motorcycling for one day if they could do without me. And Harold said no, he would fetch some water and get it boiled up. Probably already laying his plans. Sorry to make him sound so scheming, but the simple fact is, he is. When he came back with the water, he pretty obviously stayed at the stream long enough to have a bath and wash his hair. He put it on to boil, and we were sitting on a log, talking about one thing and another, when he suddenly put his arms around me and tried to kiss me. I say tried, but he actually succeeded, at least at first, because I was so surprised. Then I jerked away from him. Looking back, it seems sort of comic, although I'm still sore, and fell backward right off the log. It rucked up the back of my blouse and scraped about a yard of skin off. I let out a yell. Talk about history repeating. That was too much like the time with Jess out on the breakwater when I bit my tongue. Too much like it for comfort. In a second, Harold's on one knee beside me, asking if I'm all right, blushing right to the roots of his clean hair. When he knelt beside me and said, "Are you all right, baby?" I started to giggle. Talk about history repeating itself. But it was more than the humor of the situation, you know. If that had been all, I could have held it in. No, it was more in the line of hysterics. The bad dreams, the worrying about the baby, what to do about my feelings for Stu, the traveling every day, the stiffness, the soreness, losing my parents, everything changed for good. It came out in giggles at first, then in hysterical laughter I just couldn't stop. "What's so funny?" Harold asked, getting up. I think it was supposed to come out in this terribly righteous voice, but by then I'd stopped thinking about Harold and got this crazy image of Donald Duck in my head. Donald Duck waddling through the ruins of Western civilization, quacking angrily, "What's so funny, huh? What's so funny? What's so fucking funny?" I put my hands over my face and just giggled and sobbed and giggled, until Harold must have thought I'd gone absolutely crackers. After a little bit, I managed to stop. I wiped the tears off my face and wanted to ask Harold to look at my back and see how badly it was scraped. But I didn't, because I was afraid he might take it as a liberty. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of Franny. Oh-ho, that's not so funny. "Fran," Harold says, "I find this very hard to say." "Then maybe you better not say it," I said. "I have to," he answers, and I began to see he wasn't going to take no for an answer unless it was hollered at him. "Franny," he says, "I love you." I guess I knew all along it was just as bald as that. It would be easier if he only wanted to sleep with me. Love's more dangerous than just bawling, and I was in a spot. How to say no to Harold? I guess there's only one way, no matter who you have to say it to. "I don't love you, Harold," is what I said. His face cracked all to pieces. "It's him, isn't it?" he said, and his face got an ugly grimace on it. "It's Stu Redman, isn't it?" "I don't know," I said. Now, I have a temper which I have not always been able to control, a gift from my mother's side, I think. But I have struggled womanfully with it, as applies to Harold. I could feel it straining its leash, however. "I know," his voice had gotten shrill and self-pitying. "I know, all right. The day we met him, I knew it then. I didn't want him to come with us because I knew. And he said..." "What did he say?" "That he didn't want you, that you could be mine. Just like giving you a new pair of shoes, right, Harold?" He didn't answer, maybe realizing he had gone too far. "No one owns me, Harold," I said. He muttered something. "What?" I said, "You may have to change that idea." A sharp retort came to mind, but I didn't let it out. Harold's eyes had gone far away, and his face was very still and open. He said, "I've seen that guy before. You better believe it, Franny. He's the guy that's the quarterback on the football team, but who just sits there in class throwing spitballs and flipping people the bird, because he knows the teacher's got to pass him with at least a C so he can keep on playing. He's the guy who goes steady with the prettiest cheerleader, and she thinks he's Jesus Christ with a bullet. The guy who thinks up the initiations for the freshmen. The guy who farts when the English teacher asks you to read your composition because it's the best one in the class. Yeah, I know fuckers like him. Good luck, Fran." Then he just walked off. It wasn't the grand, trampling exit that he'd meant to make, I feel quite sure. Things to remember. I'm sorry, diary. It must be my state of mind. I can't remember a single thing. On July 30th, they met the women. They had only been on the road for an hour, and the going was slippery. There had been light rain the night before. When they swept around a curve and came upon three women trying to get a Ford station wagon back on the road, while a fourth stood by placidly, deep in her own kind of mental separation. The other three came slowly around the wagon, which was firmly in the ditch. They stared at Stu, Harold, Fran, and Glenn, as if they had come down from the skies in a flying saucer. One of them was wearing a sweatshirt with Kent State University across the front, and dark hair spilling down her back in a flood. Susan Stern. The blonde with the scratch across her forehead was Dana Jurgens. The third, a strawberry blonde of no more than 16, was Patty Kroger. The woman off in her own world was the oldest of the quartet. Her name, they discovered later, was Shirley Hammett. It was easy enough to see what had happened. A tractor-trailer rig had jackknifed across the road some weeks back. These women had come around the curve earlier this morning in the rain, just a little too fast for the conditions. Dana Jurgens was the only one who had been scratched. They had gotten off lucky. Stu dismounted his bike and walked toward them. He got no more than four steps when Susan Stern produced a very large pistol and pointed it at him. Franny caught her breath. "Which is it?" she asked. "The old woman or the dark man?" "We're headed for Nebraska, I guess," Stu said in his easy way. "You want to hide that thing somewhere, ma'am? I'm partial to my innards the way they are." For a moment, things hung suspended, and it was only later that Franny had time to wonder what might have happened if they had been headed further west, toward him. The dark-haired girl glanced at the blonde, who shrugged, then nodded. "Three men," the blonde said, and then smiled at Stu. "How are your guys at pushing, big fella?" Stu grinned. "I guess we might be pretty fair," he said. Shirley Hammett stood vacantly in the light drizzle, looking at nothing. She made Franny feel even colder than the damp day warranted. "Come on, then," the blonde said. "I'm Dana Jurgens. If you're headed that way, then we might as well all go together." When Franny came upon him, Stu was sitting on a rock and smoking a cigar. He had scraped a small round circle of bare earth with his boot heel and was using it for an ashtray. He was facing west, where the sun was just going down. The clouds had rifted enough to allow the red sun to poke its head through. Although they had met the four women and taken them into their party only yesterday, it already seemed distant. They had gotten the station wagon out of the ditch easily enough, and now, with the motorcycles, they made quite a caravan. The smell of his cigar made her think of her father and her father's pipe. What came with the memory was sorrow that had almost mellowed into nostalgia. "I'm getting over losing you, Daddy," she thought. "I don't think you'd mind." Stu looked around. "Franny," he said with real pleasure. "How are you?" She shrugged. "Up and around." "You want to share my rock and watch the sun go down?" She joined him, her heartbeat quickening a little. But after all, why else had she come out here? She had known which way he left camp, just as she knew that Harold and Glenn and two of the girls had gone into Brighton to look for a CB radio. Glenn's idea instead of Harold's for a change. Patty Kroger was back in camp, babysitting their combat fatigue patient. Shirley Hammett showed signs of coming out of her daze, but she had awakened them all around one this morning, shrieking in her sleep, her hands clawing at the air in warding off gestures. "It seems like a long way still to go, doesn't it?" she said. He didn't answer for a moment, and then he said, "It's further than we thought. That old woman, she's not in Nebraska anymore." "I know," she began, and then bit down on her words. He glanced at her with a faint grin. "You've been skipping your medication, ma'am." "My secret's out," she said with a lame smile. "We're not the only ones," Stu said. "I was talking to Dana this afternoon." She felt that interior dig of jealousy and fear at the familiar way he used her name. "And she said neither she nor Susan wanted to take it." Fran nodded. "Why did you stop? Did they drug you in that place?" He tapped ashes into his bare earth ashtray. "Mild sedatives at night, that was all. They didn't need to drug me. I was locked up nice and tight. No, I stopped 3 nights ago because I felt... out of touch. He meditated for a moment and then expanded. Glenn and Harold going to get that CB radio. That was a real good idea. What's a two-way for? To put you in touch. This buddy of mine back in Arnett, Tony Leominster, he had one in his scout. Great gadget. You could talk to folks, or you could holler for help if you got in a jam of trouble. These dreams, they're almost like having a CB in your head, except the transmit seems to be broken and we're only receiving. Maybe we are transmitting, Fran said quietly. He looked at her, startled. They sat quiet for a while. The sun peered through the clouds on its way under the earth. Fran could understand why primitive people worshipped it. As the gigantic quiet of the nearly empty country accumulated on you day by day, imprinting its truth on your brain by its very weight, the sun, the moon too for that matter, began to seem bigger and more important, more personal. Those bright sky ships began to look to you as they had when you were a child. Anyway, I stopped, Stu said. Last night I dreamed about that black man again. It was the worst yet. He's setting up somewhere out in the desert. Las Vegas, I think. And Franny, I think he's crucifying people, the ones who give him trouble. He's doing what? That's what I dreamed. Lines of crosses along Highway 15 made out of barn beams and telephone poles, people hanging off them. Just a dream, she said uneasily. Maybe. He smoked and looked west. But the other 2 nights, just before we run on those women, I dreamed about her, the woman who calls herself Mother Abigail. She was sitting in the cab of an old pickup truck parked on the shoulder of Highway 76. I was standing on the ground with one arm leaning on the window, talking to her just as natural as I'm talking to you. And she says, you got to move him along faster still, Stuart. If an old lady like me can do it, a big tough fella from Texas like you should be able to. Stu laughed, threw down his cigar, and crushed it under his heel. In kind of an absent way, as if not knowing what he was doing, he put an arm around Franny's shoulders. They're going to Colorado, he said. Yes, I think they are. Has either Dana or Susan dreamed of her? Both. And last night Susan dreamed of the crosses, just like I did. There's a lot of people with that old woman now. Stu agreed. 20, maybe more. You know, we're passing people nearly every day. They just hunker down and wait for us to go by. They're scared of us. But her? They'll come to her, I guess, in their own good time. Or to the other one, Franny said. Stu nodded. Yeah, or to him. Fran, why did you stop taking the Veranol? She uttered a trembling sigh and wondered if she should tell him. She wanted to, but she was afraid of what his reaction might be. There's no counting on what a woman will do, she said. No, he agreed. But there are ways to find out what they're thinking, maybe. What, she began, and he stopped her mouth with a kiss. They lay on the grass in the last of the twilight. Flagrant red had given way to cooler purple as they made love, and now Franny could see stars shining through the last of the clouds. It would be good riding weather tomorrow. With any luck, they would be able to get most of the way across Indiana. Stu slapped lazily at a mosquito hovering over his chest. His shirt was hung on a nearby bush. Fran's shirt was on, but unbuttoned. Her breasts pushed at the cloth, and she thought, I'm getting bigger, just a little right now, but it's noticeable, at least to me. I've wanted you for a pretty long time now, Stu said, without looking directly at her. I guess you know that. I wanted to avoid trouble with Harold, she said. And there's something else that... Harold's got a ways to go, Stu said. But he's got the makings of a fine man somewhere inside him, if he'll toughen up. You like him, don't you? That's not the right word. There isn't a word in English for how I feel about Harold. How do you feel about me? He asked. She looked at him and found she couldn't say she loved him, couldn't say it right out, although she wanted to. No, he said, as if she'd contradicted him. I'd just like to get things straight. I know you'd just as soon not have Harold know anything about this just yet. Isn't that right?
Yes, she said gratefully.
It's just as well. If we lie low, it may take care of itself. I've seen him looking at Patty. She's about his age.
I don't know.
You feel a debt of gratitude to him, don't you?
I suppose so. We were the only two left in Ogunquit, and that was luck. No more, Franny.
I suppose.
I guess I love you, he said. That's not so easy for me to say.
I guess I love you, too, but there's something else.
I knew that.
You asked me why I stopped taking the pills.
She plucked at her shirt, not daring to look at him. Her lips felt unnaturally dry.
I thought they might be bad for the baby, she whispered.
For the... He stopped. Then he grasped her and turned her to face him.
You're pregnant?
She nodded.
And you didn't tell anyone?
No.
Harold. Does Harold know?
No one but you.
God almighty damn, he said.
He was peering into her face in a concentrated way that scared her. She had imagined one of two things. He would leave her immediately, or he would hug her, tell her not to worry, that he would take care of everything. She had never expected this startled, close scrutiny.
Stu, she said in a frightened voice.
You didn't tell anyone, he repeated.
I didn't know how.
Her tears were close to the surface now.
When are you due?
January, she said, and the tears came.
He held her and made her know it was all right without saying anything.
He didn't tell her not to worry or that he would take care of everything, but he made love to her again, and she thought that she had never been so happy. Neither of them saw Harold, as shadowy and as silent as the dark man himself, standing in the bushes and looking at them. Neither of them knew that his eyes squinted down into small, deadly triangles as Fran cried out her pleasure at the end of it as her good orgasm burst through her. By the time they had finished, it was full dark. Harold slipped away silently. From Fran Goldsmith's diary, August 1, 1980. No entry last night, too excited, too happy. Stu and I are together.
Franny slept heavily and dreamlessly. So did they all, with the exception of Harold Lauder. Sometime shortly after midnight, he rose and walked softly to where Franny lay and stood looking down at her. He was not smiling now, although he had smiled all day. At times he had felt that the smile would crack his face right up the middle and spill out his whirling brains. That might have been a relief. He stood looking down at her, listening to the chirr of summer crickets. We're in dog days now, he thought. Dog days. From July the 25th to August 28th, according to Webster's. So named because rabid dogs were supposed to be the most common then. He looked down at Fran, sleeping so sweetly, using her sweater for a pillow. Her pack was beside her. Every dog has his day, Franny. He knelt, freezing at the gunshots of his bending knees, but no one stirred. He unbuckled her pack, untied the drawstring, and reached inside. He trained a small pencil flash on the pack's contents. Franny muttered from deep down in sleep, stirred, and Harold held his breath. He found what he wanted way at the bottom, behind three clean blouses and a lap-eared pocket road atlas. A spiral notebook. He pulled it out, open to the first page, and shone his light on Franny's close but extremely legible handwriting. July 6, 1980. After some persuasion, Mr. Bateman has agreed to come along with us. Harold shut the book and crept back to his sleeping bag with it. He was feeling like the little boy he had once been, the little boy with few friends. He had enjoyed a brief period of babyhood beauty until about age 3, had been a fat and ugly joke ever since. But many enemies, the boy who had been more or less taken for granted by his parents, their eyes had been trained on Amy as she began her long walk down the Miss America Atlantic City runway of her life, the boy who had turned to books for solace, the boy who had escaped never being picked for baseball or always being passed over for school patrol, by becoming Long John Silver, or Tarzan, or Philip Kent. The boy would become these people late at night under his covers, with a flashlight trained on the printed page, his eyes wide with excitement, barely smelling his own bed farts. This boy now crawled upside down to the bottom of his sleeping bag with Franny's diary and his flashlight. As he trained its beam on the front cover of the spiral, there was a moment of sanity. For just a moment, part of his mind cried out, "Harold, stop!" so strongly that he was shaken to his heels. And stop he almost did. For just a moment it seemed possible to stop, to put the diary back where he had found it, to give her up, to let them go their own way before something terrible and irrevocable happened. For that moment it seemed he could put the bitter drink away, pour it out of the cup, and refill it with whatever there was for him in this world. "Give it over, Harold," this sane voice begged. But maybe it was already too late. At age 16, he had given up Burroughs and Stevenson and Robert Howard in favor of other fantasies, fantasies that were both well-loved and much-hated. Not of rockets or pirates, but of girls in silk see-through pajamas kneeling before him on satin pillows, while Harold the Great lolled naked on his throne, ready to chastise them with small leather whips, with silver-headed canes. They were bitter fantasies through which every pretty girl at Agunquit High School had strolled at one time or another. These daydreams always ended with a gathering expletive in his loins, an explosion of seminal fluid that was more curse than pleasure. And then he would sleep, the sperm drying to a scale on his belly. Every doggie has his day. And now it was those bitter fantasies, the old hurts, that he gathered around him like yellowed sheets, the old friends who never died, whose teeth never dulled, whose deadly affection never wavered. He turned to the first page, trained his flashlight on the words, and began to read. In the hour before dawn, he replaced the diary in Fran's pack and secured the buckles. He took no special precautions. If she woke, he thought coldly, he would kill her and then run. Run where? West. But he would not stop in Nebraska, or even in Colorado. Oh, no. She didn't wake. He went back to his sleeping bag. He masturbated bitterly. When sleep came, it was thin. He dreamed he was dying halfway down a steep grade of tumbled rocks and moonscape boulders. High above, riding the night thermals, were cruising buzzards, waiting for him to make them a meal. There was no moon, no stars. And then a frightful red eye opened in the dark. Vulpine Eldritch. The eye terrified him, yet held him. The eye beckoned him. To the west, where the shadows were even now gathering in their twilight dance of death. When they made camp at sundown that evening, they were west of Joliet, Illinois. There was a case of beer, good talk, laughter. They felt they had put the rain behind them with Indiana. Everyone remarked specially on Harold, who had never been so cheerful. "You know, Harold," Franny said late that evening as the party began to break up, "I don't think I've ever seen you feeling so good. What is it?" He gave her a jolly wink. "Every dog has his day, Fran." She smiled back at him, a little puzzled. That was just Harold being elliptical. It didn't matter. What mattered was that things were finally coming right. That night, Harold began his own journal.